Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the challenges of celebrating Father's Day without a father, and a wrestling event that's about more than just wrestling. But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I don't necessarily think they're going to come on board to our plan, just as we're not going to come on to their plan. It's going to be a compromise, a collaboration. We've reached out to the Senate and to the governor's office multiple times, and they have decided to go it alone.
I support the Trump energy agenda completely, which prioritizes fossil fuel as the backbone of our power grid. We should be opening new fossil fuel plants, not closing them.
It was riddled with loopholes that would allow Chinese Communist Party proxies to own land on behalf of the government. And it didn't address any other foreign adversaries who may be seeking to do Arizonans harm.
We need to continue to support our local law enforcement. This type of proposal, the pay is something that is needed. It's been needed for a very long time.
By exercising his constitutional rights and his rights as a United States Senator to ask some questions of government officials, he was doing his job. His job is oversight. Oversight of the Department of Homeland Security.
And with me to talk about budget talks apparently hitting high gear, two new Freedom Caucus candidates and more are Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning.
And Carl Gentles of the Gentles Agency. Carl, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy Friday the 13th.
I didn't realize it is indeed Friday the 13th. Seriously. Well, so maybe that's a good introduction to the first thing we're going to talk about. Lawmakers at the Capitol on a Friday, doesn't happen all the time, to discuss a budget. The House is scheduled to vote on its budget that went through the Appropriations Committee yesterday. Senate, there's talk that the Senate is going to unveil its budget proposal today. We are about 2 weeks away from the end of the fiscal year, and the House and Senate are not on the same page.
Yeah, a little concerning, right? Typically, when you have majorities of the same party, and in the situation we have Republican majorities in the legislature, which we've had for a while, usually they get on the same page on a budget earlier in the session, right? Mm-hmm. And then it always comes down to negotiating with the governor when it comes to revenue and spending priorities and whatnot. Obviously, it's been more challenging the past few years with divided government and a Democratic governor. But this is the first time in a while where the House and Senate have gone this far into a legislative session without being on the same page on just, one, a general budget approach, and two, the priorities. And so we've seen this in the past when the House and Senate haven't been on the same page. One chamber will forge ahead with their budget plan and start things rolling in a more public forum. This is probably the best time to do it because, as you mentioned, we're 2 weeks away from the end of the fiscal year. But those conversations about a compromise need to start happening, or else this budget is, as the governor mentioned publicly yesterday, DOA, and the Senate has some other priorities that they want.
Yeah, the governor said yesterday, as Lorna alluded to, Carl, that the House budget is not one that she is willing to sign. The interesting thing, and Lorna alluded to this, there are different approaches here. The Senate is trying to do some, kind of what they did a couple of years ago, where, you know, they divide up a pot of money between the House, the Senate, and the governor. The House, and we had Representative Matt Gress on yesterday saying he's not down with that. He's not up for that. So in addition to having maybe different spending priorities, it sounds like they have to reconcile these different approaches.
Well, they are. I mean, first of all, they've got to take a different approach from the Republican side and not making this basically a demand letter, as ranking Democrat Stephanie Stahl Hamilton said. I mean, we know it's in her words, sham budget. I think she even threw Disney in there this year, which is pretty incredible. There's a lot in that bill that's just not going to make it past the budget's not going to make it past the governor's desk. I mean, so you're talking about three major things: cutting K-12 education funding again, in some respect, where you're cutting out money for books and supplies and that sort of thing. You're talking about cutting Medicare cuts and also DACA money. So, I mean, they've got to do some negotiating. It has to be done in good faith, and it's just not there right now. In fact, I think the Republicans were actually, you know, gone on vacation and at their cabins for weeks before they came back, and now they're finally getting back to the real business of the state. So we've got to have some negotiation in some real good faith.
Lorna, is it possible that by the House unveiling its budget, moving it through appropriations, voting on it today, does that kickstart negotiations? Like, does that help in any way bring the Senate and maybe the governor to the table in the sense that now saying, okay, this is a budget we can get through this chamber. These are our priorities. Let's talk about it.
Definitely. Since they're the first to kind of go public and start moving, it does put added pressure on the governor's office and to the Senate, right? Up until now, everything's been happening behind closed doors and negotiations and conversations. So us in the public, we've heard rumors, but no one's seen anything until the House unveiled their budget earlier this week, and we'll vote on it today. It's always a delicate dance, right? Anytime you're negotiating with a budget, regardless of who's in leadership and who the governor is, you always have to balance the different priorities. And so now that the House has what's much considered a conservative budget, and the governor has been outspoken with what she's opposed to, now the conversations are going to happen of what can she live with, what can these Republicans in the House, you know, forego and maintain the votes that they need. You're going to lose some Freedom Caucus members, right, when you do that. And what are you going to be able to bring on that's going to bring in Democrats? And so 2 weeks is a short time period, but we've seen this in the past. As soon as you reach a deal, things move quickly,
yeah.
Right? And so at least the conversations are happening publicly and pressure's on all parties.
Well, and to your point about maybe losing some of the Freedom Caucus members, presumably, I mean, this has been sort of the governor's MO so far. She's not going to sign something if it doesn't have some Democratic support. So yes, you're going to lose some Freedom Caucus members, but you also, if you're the House, probably have to have a budget that at least some Democrats can vote for, right?
Definitely. And again, that's what the delicate balance and dance is. And especially, I mean, the governor has been criticized by her colleagues in the Democratic Party in the past for signing onto budgets that they didn't feel really reflected the priorities of the Democratic Party, right? So I think she's being cognizant of that during this cycle, making sure that a lot more of those priorities are included in whatever the final budget looks like. But yeah, it's really comes down to 16, 31, and 1, right? And whatever configuration you need to get there. And sometimes people feel a little bit more beholden, thinking that they're going to be that deciding vote, and they get rolled and they find someone else elsewhere that they can get on board. And so We'll see what happens next week after if the House does pass out their budget today,
yeah,
and where the conversations go.
Well, and Carl, the conventional wisdom, what we keep hearing from legislators is that next week will be the week that they will get it done, because as we've been talking about, the fiscal year ends on the 30th. There's some members who are going to be leaving before that for some personal commitments. So, like, yes, once there is an agreement, to Lorna's point, it can happen pretty much in a day, basically, getting the budget done. But it seems as though there's still some negotiations to be done here. Can it happen in this amount of time?
I think it can. But, you know, you've got to strip out the things that, you know, the Democrats are against, or at least dial that back a little bit. Right. And of course, you're going to have to keep in elements of that the you know, Freedom Caucus and Republicans really want. So there is a delicate balance. Lorna is very, very right about that. The question is, you know, what is it? Where is that balance going to be? And what are Democrats going to be willing to, you know, stomach in this next budget cycle? So,
all right. So we are still working in this legislative session. Oh, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, it'll be interesting to see when the Senate does release publicly their plan, that, you know, there have been conversations that they've been, you know, deliberating with the governor's office, how different that is from the House,
yeah,
and how far apart we actually are. A lot of this is speculation right now, and obviously there's internal dynamics and personalities at play. But usually when you're negotiating a budget, it's honestly like a handful of issues that are really at play. The majority of the state budget from year to year is pretty much the same. And
yeah,
so it'll be interesting to see how far away we are.
Absolutely. So, Lorna, let me stick with you to talk about next year's election. We're already talking about next year's election. The Freedom Caucus, we've mentioned them already today, has brought forward two candidates to run for Corporation Commission, which is an important state or agency, quasi-agency. I'm not really sure how you describe
it. No one knows how to describe it.
Well, that's exactly it,
yeah,
right? Like, they have these incredible powers, but very few people know what they actually do. This is, you know, kind of a down ballot race. And we heard from one of those candidates, Ralph Heap, a state representative, talking about wanting more fossil fuel power plants in this state. I'm curious how, like, we're still obviously very far out, but, you know, we have two Republicans taking on primarying two Republicans here. How do you see that shaking out?
You know, it's always unfortunate when we have, especially for statewide offices like Corporation Commission, which, as you mentioned, are down ballot races that don't usually get a lot of attention from your average voter, where there's kind of this internal, you know, political infighting and whatnot. And so it makes for a very expensive primary, which then they're going to have to face, you know, Democratic opponents in the general, right? One, voters aren't paying any attention to this right now. You mentioned that, you know, 2026 election and everyone's kind of like rolling their eyes about everything right now because people are still recovering from 2024. But when it comes to the Corporation Commission, as somebody who's been in this field for almost 20 years now, I don't even fully understand the day-to-day operations of the Corporation Commission because it's so technical and complex when it comes to regulating utilities in the state. And so I think there is a lot of misinformation out there about the positions of the current corporation commissioners and votes they have taken and, you know, rate increases from utilities. This is very nuanced and very complex, right? And so I think there's just a lot of misinformation out there, and it's led to the situation now where there's a lot of Republican infighting going into 2026 for these races.
Yeah, I mean, Corporation Commission is one of the most important commissions that affects every single Arizonan that nobody really knows about, to your point. I mean, it's incredibly important around utilities and other services. So, I mean, you really should pay attention to this. I think what's going on is really more of an infight, like Lorna said, about, you know, how far right should that Corporation Commission be, right? So I think the two candidates are essentially being put up by, you know, Jake Hoffman to push the Corporation Commission a little bit further right than what it is. And so, I mean, that's really the infighting that's going on. Now, you know better than I do, but I think, you know, as you're looking at this, you know, the question is, how much control of that corporation commission will somebody like a Jake Hoffman and his, you know, his group have over the commission?
Well, and Carl, this is these are elections for CorpCom that Democrats have won in somewhat recent years.
Absolutely.
Like they've had members on this. I wonder though, since it's so down ballot, if that even if, you know, Freedom Caucus members are the Republican nominees, you know, the conventional wisdom is that a Freedom Caucus, you know, further left or further right candidate in the general election makes it hard to get elected. But I wonder if that's mitigated somewhat by the fact that this is so far down ballot. Does it make it harder maybe for Democrats to win these races, even if they're going up against, you know, Freedom Caucus members or more ideological candidates?
It does a little bit, but, you know, Democrats have won statewide in this last election. I mean, they hold five statewide offices right now. So, you know,
those are more at the top of the ticket, though.
And well, they were. But, you know, there's a draft that comes from that, right? And it really does depend on the quality of the candidate, right? So to get down to the ballot, and of course, the education that happens, and making sure people go down the ballot and vote the way, you know, vote down the ballot. So I think, you know, Democrats have a good chance to you know, put some Dems back on the Corporation Commission. I think having balance on that commission, especially, is a good thing. It really is, because it does affect such a wide number of people on their everyday lives. So, you know, we'll see what happens if the Freedom Caucus is able to knock off what I would, you know, it's hard to say that they're, you know, less conservative, but or less, you know, to the right. But we'll see what happens. This is a strange time we're in.
I think it's going to be difficult. You know, we'll see what comes out of the Republican primary. But I think a lot of these Republicans are going to be talking about similar things: low utility rates, you know, different types of energy consumption in the state, whatnot. I don't think there's going to be much difference when it comes to the messaging of these Republicans, because I believe at the end of the day they believe in similar things. I think that's going to be very difficult for Democrats during the general when you are defending so many statewide seats. And you're trying to pick something up, there's only so much money to go around. And there's already a lot of dysfunction within the Democrat infrastructure in the state, where it's going to come down to, will they have the resources and the infrastructure to actually knock off two Republicans from the Corporation Commission on a down ballot race?
Carl, let me start with you about Governor Katie Hobbs signing a statement with other Democratic governors, basically supporting California Governor Gavin Newsom in his opposition to the use of the National Guard in L.A. Of course, a judge yesterday said that the president could not federalize the National Guard without the governor's permission. That decision, though, is on hold temporarily. There's a lot of sort of legal machinations here. I'm wondering, though, like, you know, the governor, of course, is up for reelection next year. So it's hard. I mean, not saying that there was a political motive this, you know, we can't get it inside anybody's head. But like when you look at this move through the lens of the governor running for reelection, what comes to mind for you?
You know, it's a really challenging issue because, of course, you know, we've got to ensure that, first of all, we got to ensure that, you know, people have their right to protest and to protest without the use of force against them. And so, you know, let me just start by saying that I grew up in an Air Force family. My father's 33-year military veteran, retired as a chief master sergeant. I'm married to a 29-year Army reservist who just retired. And so service is a part of our family, and I know service is a part of all of those people that are out there in the National Guard defending the right to use their voice. And so the challenge that we have is that now we've got the use of the military against our own people. And even though that is something that, I don't think it should be occurring. I think it's absolutely wrong. I think when you talk about governors supporting Gavin Newsom, I think by and large, most governors would probably say that's not the right use of military force. And so first, I just don't think it has any place in our democracy to start with. And you know, Trump is like, you know, this effort is like Trump is like a velociraptor in Jurassic Park. He just keeps going up to the edge of the fence and see what he can test out. And that's what's going on in this issue and many other issues that we've seen.
Did not have a Jurassic Park reference on my bingo card for today. So thank you for that.
Anything Carl. Can happen on Friday the 13th.
Seriously. Right. So, Lorna, I'm curious about something that Carl mentioned, which is sort of the precedent of the president. And, of course, this has happened very rarely, but it has happened where a president has federalized the National Guard without the consultation or permission of a governor. Mm-hmm. I wonder, though, you know, the Democratic governors, of course, are supporting Gavin Newsom on this. But I wonder, even if you are a Republican governor, is there any thought of I don't mind what they're doing here. But if the roles were reversed, I sure wouldn't like it if a Democratic president federalized the National Guard and sent them to my state to deal with an issue that is a hot button issue here.
I mean, there's always that that tension between state and federal powers and whatnot. But I do think the difference is, and a Republican governor would say, well, I wouldn't have allowed the disorderly conduct and the violence to have ensued, right? I mean, that's the argument that's being made for why the National Guard was deployed, was that the situation became untenable within Los Angeles. And there was the perception that the mayor of L.A. and the governor of L.A. was having law enforcement be a little bit hands-off when it came to this situation, right? And so from the president's perspective, the National Guard was being deployed to maintain law and order, not to quell protests, not to stop people from – not to attack protesters – but to protect law enforcement who is being attacked by folks, right? And so I think that's kind of where there's a nuance between a Democrat governor and a Republican governor perspective is, you know, we've even seen that here when, you know, there was a misunderstanding about a situation here in Peoria where people started attacking Peoria police. I mean, the governor even came out quickly to clarify what the situation was. It was a drug situation, not ICE enforcement. But I think Republican governors would probably be a little bit more forward and proactive when it comes to maintaining law and order and making sure that law enforcement or ICE officials aren't being attacked by protesters.
There's no indication, though, that the police did not have the situation under control. There's really no indication of that. I think the administration was looking for an opportunity to show this use of force, if you will. And so this is a perfect opportunity for the administration to send in the National Guard to show their strongman kind of positioning and to try to send a message that anybody that opposes the administration's agenda is going to be dealt with. I mean, we're seeing this across the board. We're seeing this with all of these ICE raids that are going on. You're seeing ICE agents running down migrants in strawberry fields. It's incredible. And so I think he was really looking for an opportunity to show this force. I mean, he's got the, you know, we know that he's really loves what, you know, a foreign dictator is doing. He wants to bring in an element of that. And of course, we're waiting to see what happens tomorrow in this parade. And for me, I hope it rains so that we don't have to deal with it so much and maybe it gets washed out. But, you know, he's been, I think the administration has been looking for this opportunity to really show their force.
Lorna, of course, there's the big military parade tomorrow in D.C., but also large-scale protests planned in places across the country, including a few places here in Arizona. Mm-hmm. If you are an elected official and you've worked for governors, you've worked for other elected officials, what is the thought process in terms of, I assume there's some kind of hope that like it doesn't get violent, that things go smoothly, that there doesn't have to be National Guard called up to your city or your state?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's always the hope when there's large demonstrations and protests that things stay peaceful, right? But you have to prepare for the worst case scenario, right? And that's what every governor or local elected official, unfortunately, has to do in this day and age, because we've seen too many demonstrations, unfortunately, turn violent and whatnot. And so there's contingency plans always in place. I'm sure the governor and, you know, whether it's the mayor of Phoenix and the other municipalities where there's these planned protests are working together and collaborating, and law enforcement is. But hopefully we won't be seeing anything on the evening news about any kind of violent protests this
weekend. Do those plans include potentially, not specifically this one because we have no idea, but mm-hmm. in the past, like, would the governor be consulting with, for example, the adjutant general of the Arizona National Guard just in case?
I can't speak to those specifics, maybe now because of the dynamics that we are, or the climate that we're in right now, but definitely the Department of Public Safety would be communicating with all of the local law enforcement to make sure that resources are deployed where needed if a situation were to unfold.
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense, right? Because we do want the protests to be peaceful. We don't want any violence, and I don't expect any here in Arizona, but, you know, you never know. And so it makes sense to have a contingency plan, but working very actively with the National Guard and other agencies as a precaution just in case. And then at the request of the governor, then they deploy, not just deploying without the consent and advice of the sitting governor, which is what happened in California, which has led to all this chaos.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Carl Gentles, Lorna Romero-Ferguson, thanks to you both. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll hear about the action-packed mashup that pairs pro wrestling with drag. But first, as we close out this week's series of conversations on masculinity and its ever-evolving manifestations, we're looking ahead to Father's Day this Sunday. For a lot of people, it's going to be a great day. But for those who, for one reason or another, don't have a relationship with their dads, Father's Day can be tough to navigate. Joshua Johnson is a therapist here in the Valley, and he says it's a challenge that crops up frequently in his sessions. Johnson spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman about how he encourages his clients to find their own definitions of fatherhood.
Society markets a lot when it comes to holidays, you know, like ads such as like TJ Maxx or, you know, Five Below will have like the grill, and we're supposed to be out there grilling with our fathers or helping them with their truck or helping them with, you know, hardware tools and like mm-hmm. all these other different thoughts that, you know, get marketed out to people. And what happens is that then you have this depiction of what you think family is supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be important for anyone to kind of take back control of what holidays and things mean for them.
Yeah. Oftentimes, you know, stereotypically, it can be hard to talk to dads. Mm-hmm. And I know that not all dads are that way. But is that something that is an obstacle for you in these dynamics?
Absolutely. Actually, to be completely transparent, it's an obstacle for me in two ways. One of them being that in working with clients who struggle with that, right, but then also being a human who also struggles with that.
Mm.
And so one of the biggest things, going back to taking back control, that I found to be really helpful, not only just for me, but for my clients, is like, for example, celebrate your chosen families. Sometimes we have this thought process that, like, you know, our family's supposed to be our blood relatives. But I found to be very helpful that, you know, celebrating my friends, celebrating. If I have their parents, you know, not saying that my mom didn't do her best, right? Because she was a single mother herself. But it definitely helped me having community.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're saying even in your own life, if I'm hearing you correctly, mm-hmm. if there is cultural pressure to celebrate a father in your life, mm-hmm. it can be helpful to give yourself permission to say, like, the father that I'm celebrating might not be my biological father.
Mm-hmm. Because, again, like, there are people that are going to be in your life that's going to show up for you in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? We may not think like that subconsciously, but the reality of it is, if you really step back, well, this person may have become this father-like figure, so I could celebrate them.
So what I hear you saying there is that the thing to explore there is the nature of the father-child relationship in terms of, like, what are the key components of that relationship. What would you say those are?
We have to get comfortable, one, being comfortable with other people's decisions and choices, right? But then also, as well as getting comfortable having to teach and explain things to people. Because my definition of loving me is completely different than someone else's thought process of how they think they're loving me. And sometimes I have to explain that and kind of break that down to someone. Well, what does showing up for me look like?
Mm-hmm.
What does supporting me look like? When you look, dive deep into yourself and you're discovering these definitions, then you need to then apply it and let people in your community know. Bell Hooks says it herself, you know, rarely, if ever, are we, any of us, are healed in isolation.
Hmm. So this is making me think about, just to share an example from my own life,
mm-hmm.
I think a big breakthrough for me in my own relationship with my dad was recognizing that if I sit down and ask him direct questions mm-hmm. about emotional dynamics in our relationship that I'm struggling with or that I need some clarity on, mm-hmm. that's not necessarily going to be productive. If we're just like sitting across a table and I say, like, I want to talk to you about this thing. But then I had this experience not long ago where we went to a baseball game together and we sat next to each other for, you know, something like 4.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly we were both facing the field talking about the game. Baseball is a shared passion for us.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the game, the conversation just kind of subtly shifted into terrain where all of a sudden I found that we were talking about some questions I had about one of his brothers that we had never really mm-hmm. explored in terms of what that relationship really was. And I'm avoiding specifics here, obviously, but
right.
The communion for me,
mm-hmm.
To go with your Bell Hooks example, was to find the right container for the conversation to emerge organically.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're talking about?
Absolutely. In a way, you just dated your dad, right? Like, you know, in a way, like when you think about it, it's no different than like dating someone.
Right.
Sometimes when you have to pull people out of different environments to get them to open up, and that's just normal with people. Sometimes going out to dinner and having margaritas and a few tacos with someone, right? The atmosphere, you're out, you're about, you're doing something different, especially if we're always working, you know, and working a 9-to-5 type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or again, like how you shared that you and your dad have the same passions,
mm-hmm.
that by itself, right, creates connection,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
To then it allows communication to happen. And then soon after a while, like once that communication is established, then maybe consistency, the 3 C's I like to call them, those things kind of all work together. And the goal is just to better the relationship.
So those 3 C's are connection, communication, and consistency?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other pieces to it, too, that is going to be really important for listeners to think about, especially if we're still fostering anger or frustration towards these non-existent relationships, is that we have to remind ourselves that people are human. Maybe there's a reason why that person wasn't aligned in our life at the time that we want them to, or at all. You know, I think about, you know, just my history with my father. My father was a really angry and still is a very angry man. And if he was to stay continuously in my life from childhood until where I'm at now, I probably wouldn't even be here on this radio show talking to you.
Wow.
Do I love the wish that I had my father in the space for me to celebrate and honor him in this house? Absolutely. But that's why I'm going to honor other men that have been in my life. Even I have cousins who just recently became first time fathers. I'm honoring them. I'm stepping out of uncomfortableness and creating comfort to letting the people know in my life, hey, I don't have a family. And it's okay to say that. I don't have the family dynamic that I would wish that I had. But you guys are it. or even then for Father's Day. Maybe I'm doing all the things that I wish my dad did with me.
Mm-hmm. Rather, like doing them for yourself.
Right. Absolutely. Like even like
oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. Recently I had built the Millennium Falcon from Star Wars, right? Uh-huh. And what's crazy is that when I was a kid, I used to love Lego, wanted them so bad, all the like the bigger sets, but of course couldn't afford it, right? Because again, no, you know, my mom was a single mom, was working, and she had other children as well, right? So she was doing the best that she could. But then now as an adult, I am now parenting myself, and I bought myself that Lego set. It took me time, and even then, like, I was talking to my mom one day, and I was rushing. I was like, yeah, I'm trying to get this done by, you know, by tomorrow. And she's like, why are you rushing this?
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, you're right. This is my self-care. And so, like, this is where now I can utilize and take back control, right, and by activating self-care into taking care of me.
This is another really beautiful thing I think you've just shared, Joshua, this idea of, like, Father's Day could be an opportunity to parent yourself
mm-hmm.
and then celebrate yourself mm-hmm. for being a good parent to yourself.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing about it is that's all on me now. For me, operating in love is what's best. Because if I don't operate in love, then I sit in anger.
Well, Joshua Johnson is a licensed master social worker, a practicing therapist, and a PhD candidate. Joshua. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you, as always, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. An event taking place tomorrow night in Phoenix combines two forms of entertainment that you might not think at first blush should go together. But my next guest says, in fact, they really do. Charles Pelayo is a former pro wrestler and co-founder of WrestleDrag, which is a professional wrestling company that also includes drag performances. It is not, though, he says, drag queens wrestling. Pelayo, who goes by the name of Charles Cassis inside the ring, says there are three shows a year, including tomorrow's. He came by the studio recently to talk more about this, and we started our conversation with what the thinking behind putting these two event entertainment forms together was.
So my business partner, AB, he is a part of a softball team, the gay softball team, and he loves drag. I love professional wrestling and did it for over 10 years, and I came out in 2019. I always make a joke that me coming out started the pandemic. So I came out in December 2019, and I started to get more involved in the community, trying to discover myself, and one of my students, his brother does drag. So I went with their mom to my first drag show to see their name is Beatrix Belarouge. I went to go see her perform, and I've seen like Drag Race and stuff like that, but to see it in person, it was just like a different experience. And you realize real quick that pro wrestling and drag is pretty similar.
What are the similarities between pro wrestling and drag shows? Because sort of on the surface, one seems like a very, very sort of macho enterprise,
right,
and the other really doesn't.
Yeah, and it was. It was. I think for a very long time, it was presented as the super macho, like we're just going to beat the crap out of each other. But if you think about it, we're human beings that dress up in outfits to go perform for money, hopefully. So it's more violence-based, obviously, but on the surface, when you really think about it, we're dressing up in cool costumes, shiny outfits. We perform. We play different types of characters. We hopefully make some money. We get more popularity, and we go home.
Do you find that other people make that connection between the similarities between pro wrestling and drag shows? Like, I just wonder, like, if the Venn diagram of people who are fans of both of those things, like, how many people are in that center circle there?
Yeah, I think if you're a fan of both especially, you can see the similarities. For our shows like WrestleDrag, it's been great because we'll have people who come for the drag and people who come for the wrestling, but they see the entire show and they leave
first experience
like,
the other
exactly.
one.
Exactly. And it's they're so like, there's like, oh, this was exciting. And just whether it's the combination or just the attraction of it. But I haven't, at least to me, no one has come up to me after and said, I like the wrestling part, but the drag was, or the other way around. Like they just come in. I was like, this show was entertaining.
What was it like for you growing up doing wrestling and even, you know, as a young adult, being a professional wrestler and sort of coming to understand who you were as a person in a field where, you know, there are LGBT characters,
right,
but they're characters and they tend to be sort of portrayed in a very specific way.
Yeah. So like back in the day, I would say, in my opinion, I think it was very, because it was so macho, you had, these are all the pro wrestlers, and then here's our attraction of the gay wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all they were known for. So the gay wrestler was just this one-dimensional thing that fit every stereotype. So, like, the purpose of Wrestle Drag is to show that we have a roster complete of every part of the LGBTQ community, allies, and queens and everything, but they're, you're not getting the same thing over and over. Like, these are personalities, these are different characters, different human beings, different experiences, like everything into one, and you're just there to be entertained. And we're kind of slashing that whole, there's only room for one, we only need one of these, right? And for me growing up, I grew up in a very macho household as well, and for me, wrestling was a big escape. So as I got into wrestling, even though it was being more open, it was more inclusive, there was still, it was still a little terrifying. And the way I looked, the way I'm presented, to me added a little bit more, because I'm like, I'm going to be looked at in a certain way. The character I played is just going to be judged for everything if I come out. And it was scary. It was a scary process. And once I figured out exactly like where I stood and who I was, I was like, okay, now do I take this with me forever, or do I just come out? And if I come out, do I have to be ready to not wrestle anymore, not be accepted? But when I came out, the most positive, overwhelming experience and response when I did, it was insane. It was incredible. Just all the support I got from like every direction.
It's interesting because I wonder if, even maybe subconsciously, you know, as a wrestler, as we've talked about, you're playing a character. And as you were trying to figure out who you are and then how to let other people know about that, I imagine in some ways, outwardly anyway, before you came out, you were also playing a character, maybe a different one than your wrestling character.
Oh, yeah. I was told that my character was essentially my shadow self.
Ah.
So it was everything that I couldn't be or I wanted to be. I in real life, I'm not a confrontational person. R3 or Charles Cassis, very confrontational.
Hmm.
I'm not big on like violence. R3 Cassis, very violent. So if you see, it's funny because even people see my pictures of me and then me in gear, and they say they're like, I know it's you, but they look like two different human beings.
Wow.
And when I came out, one of the things that I didn't want to do is feed into like the stereotypes. Like, now that I'm out, I don't want to be known as, I don't want that to be the thing. I'm still me. And yeah, I mean, the best part was being able to represent my community on my gear, on my clothing, and be more open about stuff. And it helped on every aspect. Like, it was just such a huge weight lifted off.
Did you find that in some way, having experience with playing a character, as it turns out, was kind of like who you actually are?
Yeah.
Did that help in some way in your decision to ultimately come out?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Just the people. I mean, wrestling became, and still is, like my entire life. So meeting people and listening to experiences and just learning from all that, because you kind of get thrown to the wolves. You have to be a certain way and have certain traits. It's funny because I was scared to come out because I thought I would lose wrestling, but wrestling and everybody in it is what helped me make the decision to come out in the end.
To you, does Wrestle Drag take on any different significance this year, given what's going on nationally with, you know, for the LGBTQ community?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, the show coming up is our 3-year anniversary, and we've always had like the message of safe for fans, safe for our wrestlers, for staff. And we just try to help people within the community. We've raised money for like scholarships. And yeah, now with like potential defunding of certain charities and hotlines, like this is more important now than ever. Even if it's as simple as providing a space for someone to feel comfortable and safe for 3 hours and entertained, and for us to simply just reassure the crowd, for me to go out there and just say, hey, this is, here's the message. We're going to keep going. We're not going to stop the show. Because obviously when stuff like this happens, there is a fear. Like, hey, if we do shows, we're going to get shut down. Is this going to not be allowed anymore? But I don't think we can live, and I don't want to live like that. So we're going to keep doing the shows, providing the space. But if all we can do is provide the space and help charities whenever we can, I think it's worth doing.
All right. That is Charlie Pelayo, co-founder of Wrestle Drag Inside the Ring. He's known as Charles Casas. Charlie, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Whether we laugh at them or groan at them, we've all heard our share of dad jokes. And with Father's Day coming up on Sunday, we wanted to revisit my conversation about dad jokes from last fall with Valley comedian and father Anwar Newton. We started by trying to define what a dad joke actually is.
Dad jokes are, honestly, it's anybody who's a dad who makes a joke. That's the that's
so the content doesn't matter.
I feel like if you have dad energy, if you like are not cool, it's like a ring. You're cool, then you're not cool, and then you're so not cool that it's kind of cool again.
Oh, okay.
You know, you're like, it's kind of cool how uncool you are. You
okay.
know, they have niches of subgroups, normie behavior. They call it dad core, things like that. It's all of a sudden cool again. But dad jokes, if it doesn't upset you a little bit, that it's so joyful. I think that's the core of a good dad joke. It's upsetting how innocent and joyful it is.
Like everyone's rolling their eyes except the dad who's telling the joke.
Yeah, like if you're in a harrowing situation and someone has pointed out that someone's butt is exposed, that's sort of a dad joke energy. It's like, yeah, I guess there is a butt there.
So here's my big question about it. So I have two kids and I am frequently accused of making dad jokes. But in my opinion, at least, I've had the same sense of humor since I was like in my 20s, long before I had kids. So like, have I always just had a dad sense of humor? Like, do they become dad jokes once my first child is born? Like, how does that work?
That's interesting. That I'd never thought of it in that way. And as soon as you were saying it, I was like, that's actually very interesting because comedy changes and comedy sensibility changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people can tell the difference between what's comedically highbrow now and what was comedically highbrow, say, 20 years ago, or even generally what people accepted as being very funny. I think about the early aughts and a lot of the humor was just mean. And now if you go back and look at those now, a lot of people are like, what was going on 20 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Is everything up? Comedy changes. So I think it's like if you keep an era of comedy in your heart and you take it forward, then it's all of a sudden in this dad, it's like an obsolete sense of humor that's sort of refreshing.
That's really interesting. You know, and, you know, one of the things I've read, you know, doing some research on, you know, what constitutes a dad joke is there are some people who say that a dad joke is the kind of joke that only a father will tell. Like someone else, in theory, like anyone can tell these jokes.
Yeah.
Like dads don't have a monopoly on, you know, cheesy wordplay or anything like that. But dads are seemingly the only ones who, I don't know, maybe have the guts to say it?
Try to put
a positive spin on it?
Yeah, I don't know if it's guts. I think it's that
lack of self-awareness?
Lack of situational awareness. And I was thinking about just dad jokes in general. And it's a lot of times it's just like having a certain level of joy in a situation where it's mundane. Like one of my favorite dad-isms, I don't know if it's necessarily a dad joke, but some people would say it is. It's like when you go to a restaurant with the family and you finish all the food and the waiter comes and grabs the plate and the dad goes, hated it. It's the cleanest dad joke there is. And it's like only a dad would make that.
Right.
No kid is making that. And if, you know, if you're not a dad, you're making that. People are like, what's going on? What are you trying to do here? Let's just leave and pay the bill.
Yeah. So you have two young children. Have you found yourself working dad jokes into your routines? Do you find that you are making dad jokes at home now? Like that you would never have thought of having done that before your kids were born?
Yeah, my butt humor has gone through the roof in the household. With a 4-year-old, butt humor is cream of the crop.
Yeah.
I have found a lot of trouble personally bringing my dadness to the stage because I wasn't that. And I didn't have any plans to be a dad early on. So a lot of my humor was social and political and commentary on sort of what's going on in adults' lives.
Mm-hmm.
And now I find myself talking about family as something I never really did. But I would be amiss to say, you know, a lot of my set is talking about my kids now. And one of my favorite jokes to do on stage is to it's not even a joke. It's I'll wiggle my glasses like this.
Okay, up and down.
I started wearing glasses when I had a kid, and I'll wiggle my glasses like Groucho Marx up and down.
Yeah.
And prior to me doing this, I've talked about a myriad of different topics, and I'll come at the audience and be like, if you don't laugh at this, there's no joy in your heart, you know? And that's the heart of a dad joke. It's like, it's just joyful for no reason.
It's interesting because it sounds as like, in your mind at least, part of the purpose of a dad joke is maybe to diffuse a difficult situation or put others at ease and maybe shift the concern or the worry or the problem from one thing and put it on themselves.
That's the perfect way of putting it. I think that is at the heart of a lot of dad jokes. And when you think about most situations, that's the best person to have around. The person that's still in the midst of so much crap is like, let's smile a little bit. Yeah, I know the car is broken down or in the middle of nowhere. And then you make a dad joke situationally about where you were going. I'm not very good at dad jokes yet.
Well, your kids are young. You've got time.
I'm still learning. I'm 4 years into like dad jokes. I feel like you got to have like a teenager to really seal in a good dad joke.
Yeah. Let me tell you, they love them.
Yes. I think that's why you do them. It's like, oh, you're going to hate it.
That was my conversation from this past fall with Valley comedian and dad Anwar Newton. We also asked some folks around the newsroom for their best or worst dad jokes.
Did you hear about that new pirate movie? It's rated R.
My dad used to tell me I wanted to be a doctor, but I didn't have any patience.
Okay, something that we always do. My son, he's 8, comes back in smelling like grass and dirt and hay and sweaty. So I'm like, there's my little farm animal.
If I go up to my dad and I say, hey, dad, I'm tired, my dad will respond back by saying, hi, tired, I'm dad.
Classic.
That was KJZZ senior field correspondent Matthew Casey, Morning Edition host Phil Latzman, senior tech support specialist Jason Cannell, and the show's assistant producer Ayanna Hamilton. And no joke, that's it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Sam Dingman, I am Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.